Welcome to Worker Movement, a podcast dedicated to the working class, a podcast dedicated to raising class consciousness. This podcast is for you, for us, for the worker.
On this episode, we're going to discuss worker exploitation. We've spent a lot of time discussing how cops are kind of generally bad for society, but we've also left out the fact that all cops are workers as well and are being exploited in a manner just like all other workers.
Yeah, so let's define what a worker is, just so we can have this idea between all of us and not really fight amongst each other about what a worker is. And you know, we talk about, you know, class-based divide, and we'll talk about a ton about the bourgeois, which is the capitalist class. They don't work. Everybody else, if you don't own capital or have enough capital to take care of yourself, you are a worker. And let's say another way, if you have to do a transaction, like if you have to give your work to receive money or give your work and barter for some other object that you need or want, you are a worker. That's it. If your work gives you and supplies you your money or supplies you with your everyday life, worker. And then there is this middle class, the people, the most dangerous class. This is the petite bourgeois. This is the upper middle class. These are the workers that want to be capitalists and are so close to being there in their brain that they're willing to turn their back hard on the worker below them. We'll go on that maybe a little bit later in this podcast, but let's go back to what the cop is. And the cop is a worker. They are a 100% transactional group of people. They punch in, they do whatever class traitor shit they have to do. They get a beat and shoot poor people. They have to go arrest people. They have to pull you over on your way to work because they have to meet their quota. Whatever class traitor shit they do, that's what the cop does. Now, we all present ourselves as class traitors once in a while. You know, if you're a manager of a Burger King, you have to crack the whip and make sure that you exploit your workers and make faster throughputs. If you are a, let's say, storm chaser, you're going to go out and try to get money for a new roof from some elderly person down the block and rip them off. If you're going to be at a restaurant, you may not give a tip all the way because they're rude to you, but you don't know why that worker was having a bad day. Things like that. We all do those class traitor type ideas and things all day long. But by far, majority of the time, the cops are always class traitors, and so are capitalists. And so if we come at it from the idea that as a worker, you are always exploited, and if you know that, then you're going to come around and be a lot, hopefully, more empathetic to the other workers around you.
Yeah, so there's plenty of workers that are put in a position where their transaction of exchanging their labor for some other object of value fucks other people over. And this is basically the capitalist society we live in, where everybody's being exploited. So we talked a little bit on the previous episode about material conditions. And for the vast, vast, vast majority of everybody on planet Earth, the material conditions dictate that we wake up in the morning, we go commit hours and hours and hours to some entity that is exploiting us in exchange for money so that we can buy food, clothes, basic, you know, kind of human essentials, however you want to classify those. Those are the material conditions driving working, the act of going to work. And this idea that, oh, well, you know, if you love your job, you'll never work a day in your life is just dog shit capitalist messaging that tries to convey that the fact that you're being exploited is fine. So all these workers in the entire world go to work. Some might have more class traitor-ish jobs than others. Cops generally are always class traitors. They're serving the ruling class, but at the same time, their material conditions are requiring that they do this act in order to sustain their existence. And we shouldn't judge people for that because the material conditions are what is driving their actions, not morals or ethics or anything like that, because those things don't exist under capitalism.
In effect, it's the material conditions that drive your ethics and your morals. And it is this divide between individuals that you'll see society always clashing. Individuals that may have grown up in a rural area or have different material conditions, which led to different ethics, and what they see as ethics and their ethos and their pathos. And you're going to see the same thing with inner city versus upper middle class and suburban life and apartment complexes and condos versus living in your house for 20 acres versus a farm lap, all these things versus the rich and poor and all this. So the material conditions drive who you are. It's also about work ethics, you know, when you're going through school or at your first job, et cetera. So, you know, the idea that you can get away from it is pretty tough, especially if we talk about how, you know, like education will always help you get out of these sort of, you know, issues. Like just going to school and going to college will let you get out of your lower class and into the upper middle class and things like that. Except that there are material conditions like, you know, not being able to pay for higher education, not having a mentor that teaches you how to buckle down and prepare yourself for the amount of homework that you're going to have, the amount of work you're going to have to do, right? There's nothing that prepares a lower class person for what it's going to take for them to drive potentially in the college level, right? Because the middle class have already had tutors to help prepare them, have already taken their ACTs and been told their whole life what it looks like, because in general, they're going to have someone who's already went to college mentor them. So just an example of what material conditions are that drive other places or drive your who you are.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about unions. So unions generally exist as a collective force to have all workers sort of advocate for the common good. There are good unions, there are bad unions, and what we mean by good and bad is to what extent do unions actually advocate for worker interests, and to what extent do unions sort of advocate for other motivations? And there are unions that, you know, are all good, and there are unions that are all bad, and there's some continuum in the middle. Some unions have private motivations. They want to persist some value set. The cop union is a good example of a bad union because they are largely unconcerned about the actual workers and more concerned about eliminating accountability from the workers to serve the ruling class. And while this does have the indirect benefit of appearing to advocate for the individual workers by kind of removing accountability and erasing punishment and kind of absolving workers of potential wrongdoing responsibility, it ultimately hurts society, which includes the workers, by incurring costs associated with lawsuits and litigation. But the union doesn't care because the union's motivation is to serve the ruling class by eliminating this accountability so that the police can operate with impunity while serving the ruling class, which is kind of what the police force is all about. We discussed that on the previous episode.
So if we take a look then at what cops are and why it's so tough to give them any slack, is the fact that they choose a profession in which they know these violations occur.
So that's an example of a bad union that not only kind of damages the worker, but it also damages society and kind of has this recursive spiral of lack of accountability, which leads to kind of the degradation of institutions. You have good unions. We'll talk about, like, I don't have a specific example, but let's say you work at a grocery store and your union advocates for, you know, you need X amount of sick time, you need X amount of vacation time. You should only have to do some, you know, laborious task for some period of time before a break. Like, these are all good collective working improvement kind of advocacy positions that unions can advocate. And so long as unions aren't doing some of this stuff with ulterior motives, like the cop unions do, we should encourage union membership and the creation of unions if one does not exist.
Yeah, we hear this all the time about why unions are bad. They take my money, the 2 hours a week or whatever it is, except that in general, union workers make more money. So they actually earn more than that 2 hours that they gave back to the union every week. And one thing to keep in mind is that the union is a body of people that are made up of the members. And so if you have an issue within your own union, you need to step up and be a leader and potentially, you know, move leadership around if you need to. There are elections and things like that. But also, you know, if you're not in one, just understand that it's made up of the individual workers. And so we'll see a ton of conflict that happens. And one of them was just the UAW, you know, asking GM for concessions that had things like you can never automate certain things, or some really interestingly or they can't make so many electric vehicles, things that you would say is counterproductive. But at the end of the day, the union workers there are afraid to lose jobs, and they're afraid of what happens to them as it goes along. So it's important that you understand through their lens why they're asking for this. And the other point of this is that if your union membership is made up of, you know, high school diploma people or, you know, not highly educated individuals, you know, your leadership will be made up of that same way. And so they're fighting against highly trained lawyers whose job it is to break the union's contracts continuously. And so you'll see some of these, so what we consider to be, you know, really insane, you know, asks from the union side, but that's just a tactic they have to do in order to fight off what the companies want to do, which is ultimately break the union to reduce payroll so they can increase their margins. And you're going to see this time and time again. You'll see one company buy another company and then close a plant and then reopen it up later so that there's no union in there. They don't have to hire back other employees because there's no universal union for all workers. There is a bunch of, you know, separate and smaller unions that are all fighting for a common good. And so let's jump into things that aren't unions that are just as class traitorous and terrible. And that's things like the idea of tenured faculty or city administrators or people that have been hired in and basically have a for life job like judges. So tenured faculty, once they get tenure, they basically can't be fired. And so they'll sit around and do what they want all day, teach the same material, and they'll never see, you know, any advancements in any coursework. But at the same time, tenured faculty need to be there because it prevents them from being fired, you know, for speech issues. And so in some of the more leftist circles, you need to have tenured faculty so you don't lose them. But do you really need tenured faculty whose job it is to serve on boards and to serve other places, not part of the university, because they're tenured? Same thing with prosecutors who's advocating for broken windows crimes or drug task force. Someone asked me the other day, why are drugs illegal? And I said, it's because when you smoke opium, you don't work as hard. And they said, what does that mean? And I said, you make drugs illegal because it disrupts the worker or the laborer all day long. That's why you can't drink on the job, but it's legal to drink. Cigarettes are legal because it's a stimulant. Caffeine's legal, that's a stimulant, right? And so they basically allow certain drugs that let the worker recover faster and get back to work. The harder drugs, maybe not so much. Anyways, but back to the prosecutor, that you know, they're going to be spending all their time, even though they're a worker, they get paid $100,000 a year, whatever it happens to be, so they're upper middle class. But their job is to make it appear that the police are doing a good job. The same thing with the city administrators. Their job is to make it appear that the city is helping you, the parks department, make it appear that the parks are there good for you. So there are lots of examples of why, just as workers, you spend your day being class traitors. Individuals who should be helping you are actually helping out, you know, big business all day long.
Yeah, so if we spend a little bit more time on some of these workforces, these are the workforces that represent institutions in government that should be eliminated because they don't serve the public interest. And while it can be argued that each one of these professions is intended to serve the public interest, and I would argue that they are, the sort of perversion of like the cultural kind of behavior of the actual people or the actual workers lends itself to not actually serving the public good. So you mentioned tenured faculty. They serve on boards, but they also have an incentive to perpetuate their own existence ahead of the kind of public education objective that they, you know, allegedly seek to pursue by teaching and advancing science and medicine and arts and whatever their field is. They'd rather sit and have their, you know, six-figure payment where they can teach the same class every year. They turn the crank. They don't really have to care about teaching. This kind of gets into teaching versus research, where people that are tenured, you know, might like to do research. And, I mean, that's fine. Not against research, not against teaching. Need both of them, whatever. But once you get tenure, you don't have you don't really have an obligation to uphold the institution's objectives anymore. You're just there existing, collecting a paycheck, and that harms the institution. Same with city administrators. And this is especially true in kind of weak executive government styles, like smaller-ish towns that have a weak mayor that might have a city council that's part-time. The city council will basically appoint a city administrator who does everything, and the city council is kind of a rubber stamp for whatever the city administrator wants. And this creates kind of a layer of indirection of no city council member can actually be held accountable because they all vote in unison. But the city administrator is the one truly running the city, but the voters never really get to weigh in on who should actually leave the city. They think they're weighing in when they vote for city council members, but the vast majority of people couldn't name a city council member in their town or city if their life depended on it. So it's a bureaucratic layer that seeks to eliminate accountability from an institution that is intended to serve the public. Largely the same with prosecutors. Prosecutors, they focus on their broken windows crimes. They want to make the police stats look good so that people say, oh, they're doing a good job of preserving law and order. Well, really, law and order is just a basically white privilege of persisting everything that is good currently because it's good for me without regard to how this system might be damaging others. So prosecutors are upholding the institution of law and order, which is the current cultural legal system that oppresses minorities and basically enforces the lower class divide by selectively determining what to enforce. They enforce blue collar crimes, but they don't enforce white collar crimes because white collar crimes are largely done for the benefit of the ruling class.
Yeah, and let's ask ourselves, what can we do about this? It's really hard because at times it can feel daunting that there are so many institutions that are in place that are going to stand in your way of any type of change. And this is true amongst everything, right? The bureaucracies are huge everywhere because it's taken years to tear down the competence in the government or put in place what they want. So it's taken years of, let's say at the federal level, of a president appointing a political person, not a piece there, political appointee for a position, right? But it's a political appointee, which means they can be fired at any time. So what happens? The bureaucracy waits and finds a job for them, fills that role with a political appointee. So now you have someone whose job in the government was because they're appointed to a position and their belief system is that of the previous president. And so you end up with a corruption that's through the entire institution that way. Or you think of city councils that haven't changed over because nobody votes for city council because nobody knows who they are. Everybody votes for the incumbent whose name they know on the paper, but don't actually know who they or what they vote for, because most times individuals don't go to a city council meeting or don't know what was rubber stamped. They don't know what institutions that they are corrupting inside of it. They don't know anything about their city council. And this is where you come in here, because if you're listening to this podcast and you're a worker and you got to know what you can get involved with, number one, it's trying to understand what the city council is up to. And that is reading the minutes. You can find your website, it's supposed to be posted in the public. You can find the meeting minutes to your, you know, city council. You can know what your prosecutor is going after. You can do all the things to find out locally how to get involved and to stop, you know, that corruption. Things like approving permits for buildings that you don't want in your city because you can increase traffic or increase crime, like a casino, theoretically, whatever they happen to say, or things that are going to tear out wetlands, whatever it is. You know, you can get involved and try to stop the city council from doing that. The next thing is, and this is maybe, you know, a little bit harder because you have to untrain yourself, is to look through basically rose-tinted glasses at everybody else. In this case, it's not rose-tinted. We'll call them worker-tinted glasses. And understand that everybody is a worker and everybody around you does work and everybody has a home life that's different than yours. And so when you see a waitress being, you know, shitty or not happy or being short with you, you don't know it's whether or not they don't like their job, whether or not they have someone at home that's sick, whether or not they're having a bad day, whether or not they got their electricity shut off. You have no idea what there is. So your kindness has to come through for all workers. That also means employees that you have next to you, you might be over. You know, if you're our manager, to make sure that you're helping out your entire crew if it comes to like fast food to hit their numbers, or if you're working at a retail shop to not throw someone else under the bus. I mean, it's a really tough mindset change, but we're looking through worker color glasses is what we have to do for all of us to change what we are and who we are and to fight off capitalism, because right now capitalism is failing us and it is, you know, killing us slowly.
For future episodes and to learn more about the worker movement, join us at workermovement.com.